This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available real-time traffic alerts. More at acura.com/RDX.
This podcast is a production of kcrw.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, is that laughter coming from your TV fresh or canned? We'll talk to Chuck Lorre, creator of some of the most popular sitcoms in TV history. Plus, USC students practice the art of the pitch, and we ain't talking baseball. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Stick around, it's The Business from NPR. We begin the caravan with news that Grey's Anatomy star Isaiah Washington has decided not to submit himself for Best Supporting Actor consideration in this year's Emmy Awards. However, the Academy has already put him up for a new category, Apologetic Bigot of the Year. But with stiff competition from the likes of Michael Richards, Mel Gibson, and Don Imus, it's anybody's ballgame. Meanwhile, Democratic Senators Hillary Rodham Clinton and Barack Obama continued to schmooze Hollywood big time, wrapping up the so-called money primary with overflowing coffers. As of last week, Clinton had coaxed just over $800,000 from Hollywood donors, while Obama netted $661,000. But not everyone in Tinseltown is going blue. While former Tennessee Senator Fred Thompson hasn't yet announced his candidacy, he's already being called a successor to that other character actor, Ronald Reagan. Better known as District Attorney Arthur Branch from Law & Order, Thompson is thinking about returning to real-life public service after he left the Senate in 2002 to pursue his acting career. After all, nearly 60% of Republicans tell pollsters they're dissatisfied with their party's current field. As syndicated columnist Mona Charon observed, it may be that no one can play a Republican president better than Fred Thompson. And here's the next installment in the ongoing saga of Lucky and Flo, the Motion Picture Association's DVD sniffer dogs. The specially trained black labs led Philippine law enforcement officials to 300,000 pirated DVDs in Manila malls. The seizures also contained a fair amount of child pornography. Authorities said they knew they'd found a huge kiddie porno stash when Flo began barking Gary Glitter's Rock and Roll Part 1. In other news, you know the record business is in trouble when the world's top recording artists have to appear on American Idol. The first quarter of 2007 was a train wreck, with CD sales plunging nearly a third compared with the same week last year. And week to week, nearly all of the albums in the top 40 posted double-digit drops. Indeed, the only album to suffer less was Jennifer Lopez's new album, and then apparently only because she appeared on American Idol the week before. Finally, our Hollywood Headline of the Week award goes to Variety executive editor Michael Spire. The trade paper reports that Lisa Rinna will take over the TV Guide Channel's red carpet fashion coverage from Joan and Melissa Rivers. The headline? Silence of the Hams. Yeah, I should talk. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up next, laughter shouldn't come from a can. The general consensus is that canned laughter was first used on TV in the 1950s on the Hank McCune Show. The producers weren't getting the laughs they needed, so they added laughs taped from other, clearly funnier, shows. It became more technical during the 1960s with the invention of the so-called laugh organ, which used pedals and buttons to produce a variety of laughs, from chortles to guffaws to outright belly laughs. You could even control the age and sex of the laughers.
Now that's what I call magic.
She opened the garage door.
So what do you want me to do, applaud?
No, she opened it. No hands, nothing. She just sat there.
Well, why don't you stop? They probably got an electric door like they demonstrated down at the market.
I don't believe it. She opens doors without electricity. Somebody ought to tell the electric company they're losing a bundle on her.
I'm losing a bundle on you. I have to pay for a glass door. Eyeglasses, lessons in how to read would be cheaper.
All right, go ahead and joke. I'm telling you she's strange.
She's strange. You're strange.
So prove it.
Prove you're strange.
Prove they've got an electric door.
How?
Go over and ask them.
I will. Tonight I'll go.
Why do you have to wait until tonight?
Because if I have to look like an idiot, I'd rather do it in the dark.
But TV show creators were already starting to rebel by the early 1970s. Larry Gelbart, the creator of MASH, said that he wanted the show without a laugh track. Quote, just like the actual Korean War. Though some sitcoms still use canned laughter, it's a hell of a lot more sophisticated and subtle.
Okay, Latvius was the son of which apostle? And I'll need that in the form of a question.
I don't know. I can't believe they're making me take this test.
Hey, did you talk to the doctor?
No.
All right, next time you see him, show him this.
You took her medicine.
Well, not on purpose. I was hoping there'd be a name on the tube. When are you seeing him again?
I don't know. We got into this whole thing about how podiatrists aren't real doctors.
How could you say that?
Many producers do not use fake laughs at all. Chuck Lorre's one of them. He created Grace Under Fire, Sybil, Dharma and Greg, and Two and a Half Men, currently the number one sitcom in primetime. Chuck Lorre, welcome to the business.
Thanks for inviting me.
Why do all sitcoms have a studio audience?
I think traditionally situation comedies were an extension of vaudeville and theater, putting on a play. And there's a certain energy that's generated by a live audience that that impacts on the performances and gives you, you know, creates a communal experience, I think, when you're watching it.
Now, when most people assume that, yes, there's a live audience, but that the laughter they hear is, you know, punched up somehow with machinery or something like that, does that happen a lot in TV? And how does it work with your show?
It doesn't happen on my show or any shows I've ever been on. That sounds horrific, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Write material that isn't funny and then have a machine laugh at it. I wouldn't want to do that for a living.
It sounds kind of horrific and like some sort of Mengele creation. There was something called the laughter organ, and it would be used on certain shows where, you know, there were literally keys you could press for titter and chortle and guffaw and
mm-hmm.
white.
I've seen the boxes. They do exist.
Really?
Yeah, they do exist. They're originally done with like tape loops. And I guess they're digital now, mm-hmm. but we have 200 plus people who come see the show on Friday night, and we string mics over their heads. And if they don't laugh, then we rewrite the material on the spot, or we cut it, but we don't air it because that would be self-defeating. I mean, the point of putting on the show is to hopefully, you know, to provoke laughter. That's the only reason we're on television. So if we know right there that it is not working, why would we proceed? It just doesn't make any sense.
You rewrite on the spot.
Absolutely. Or we cut the material, you know, or we try and figure a way to excise the material that isn't working, you know, because that audience is our barometer for whether or not our judgment is right. I mean, sometimes, you know, you can get married to material and you feel in your heart that this is, you know, comedy gold. And 200 people will just, you know, you'll hear your career going by. You just hear the crickets and you just, oh.
Frogs.
We were wrong. If you're promising laughter, you should deliver. It'd be like, you know, no pasta at the Italian restaurant. You better, you know, show up with some, you know, linguine.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about how your show works. You've taped now. It's Friday night that you do this. People are, they're there for a good time. It's Friday night.
Yeah.
How do you sort of, do you warm them up first?
Yeah, there's a warm-up entertainer who's, you know, getting everybody, first of all, you know, establishing what the rules are, you know, as far as those are live mics overhead, you know, don't make a spectacle out of yourself because we'll have to cut, you know, we'll have to, you know, it's not going to air with someone, you know, making noises or whatever, or, you know, or calling out their name, you know, there's certain rules. This is going to be for broadcast. So, you know, the audience is encouraged to laugh if they see fit to laugh. And he also tells them, you know, okay, the next scene is 1 week later. You know, he's got the script in his hand and he'll be something of a guidepost because sometimes with costume changes and makeup and hair and whatnot, they can wait 20 minutes between scenes.
Now, who is him in this case?
It's a fellow named Mark Sweet, who's quite a wonderful comedian and warm-up. And he keeps the audience focused because it takes us...
He's not a writer on the show.
No,
he's just somebody
but it takes us 3.5 hours to do a 22-minute half hour in front of an audience.
So, but let's talk about the laughter in those 22 minutes.
Right.
What's the process by which you go back over this stuff and...
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing that the misunderstanding about laughter on a show like this is it's rampant and kind of we're pretty much resigned to the fact that it seems like it'll be forever misunderstood.
Well, we're going to fix it here today.
Yeah, this will do it. This will do it. Very often we'll actually pull laughs out or bring them down in the mix of the sound mix so that dialogue can be heard because you know key dialogue can be missed over 200 people laughing.
So you're actually taking laughter out of
yeah,
the show.
Out. And you know and there's times too that you know in all fairness that when we cut film, you know, and sometimes you'll cut, you know, in order to make the show on time or you know the actor did a scene a couple of times and the second take was better than the first take, but parts of the first take were really good and you want to combine the two, you know, you're cutting and so the cutting will actually cut sound as well. So, you know, you have to then in post-production smooth out that edit, you know. You'll have an audience laughing and then it cuts off abruptly because you've switched takes, you know. So that then involves a laugh guy who will smooth that laugh out in post-production so that it doesn't you don't hear ha ha ha
as if someone's just been hit on the head.
Somebody been hit on the head because we've cut the film. That's the extent that we need that guy in post-production too.
Is there a dedicated laugh guy whose job it is?
There's guys that do that. Yeah, and they have, you know, they have systems. These are all digital systems now. But even still their function is not to pretend that something's funny when it's not, at least not on my watch. It's not. That's just hateful. When you watch a show and you hear people laughing and you're not, it's alienating. It's kind of like, you know, it's got to be, it's a really disorienting or at the very least disheartening thing and you want to change the channel. And so I don't see any reason to do that. It seems to be self-defeating.
What's the conversation like with the network, though? I mean, have there been conversations where you've started a new program, you're the creator, and you have to sort of set things up at the outset?
Different networks have different needs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
in your experience,
they think in terms of, you know, they're trying to see the big picture. Let's presume they see the big picture, and sometimes the big picture for them is, for instance, on CBS, they have four. Shows in a row on Monday night that have audiences. Although I don't think How I Met Your Mother uses an audience. I think that show actually does add laughter. I think they shoot that without an audience, if I'm right. It could be. Now, if you were to put a show like The Office on Monday night in the middle of three comedies with audiences, it would be an odd flow. So I mean,
it'd be jarring
because entirely different approaches to creating a comedy. You know, neither one is wrong. They're just different approaches. So, and if you put them back to back from a network viewpoint, and again, I'm presuming to know their job, I'm guessing that would not flow with them.
So a show like How I Met Your Mother has laughter added in simply because it would be too jarring
to
see.
You know, they shoot 25, 30 some odd scenes in a half hour or even more. You can't do that in front of a live audience. There's costume changes, there's set changes, there's, it would take forever to do that. Mm-hmm. And it becomes an impossible feat. I mean, that becomes a hybrid of sorts, you know.
The unwritten rule of primetime is that all half-hour shows, except animated shows, have laugh tracks. How hard is it to...
I don't know if that's the case at all. I mean, there seems to be a real, you know, surge towards doing the film-style shows.
Mm-hmm. Shows like Andy Barker, which is new this season, is a sort of half-hour comedy.
Yeah, it's a kind of throwback to like the Get Smart era and whatnot.
Although Get Smart used a laugh track.
It certainly did, and it was shot like a film. Yeah. I mean, I think maybe a lot of people's viewpoints about laugh tracks are holdovers from the 60s and 70s, where shows like Bewitched, which were shot like films, added laughs, you know. And that was, you know, it was kind of cynical, but that's the way they were done. And it worked then, you know. But then you have great comedies, you know, like Cheers and Seinfeld and All in the Family. They're shot in front of a studio audience. And, you know, can you imagine going into a theater to see Sideways and there's laughter, you know? I mean, after Paul Giamatti says something about wine and Merlot and you hear laughter coming from the speakers in the theater, it'd be horrifying. Why would you do it at home to somebody watching something like that at home?
Me. If you want to be in lightweight, then that's your call, but do not sabotage me.
Oh, aye, Captain. Yeah.
And if they want to drink Merlot, we're drinking Merlot.
Oh, no, if anybody orders Merlot, I'm leaving. I am not drinking any Merlot.
Okay. Relax, Miles. Jesus, no Merlot. Did you bring your Xanax? Do not drink too much. Do you hear me? I don't want you passing out or going to the dark side. No going to the dark side.
Okay.
Are there situations where the audience doesn't get to see a scene in sort of continuity and you have to sort of deal with that?
No, we always show the show in continuity. I mean, they see the entire episode. When we have to shoot a scene in a car, for instance, and you can't do that in front of an audience. Or if you watch the show, sometimes you'll see scenes on the deck that overlooks the ocean. And when you're shooting the other way, you have to put up a wall because the audience is looking into the living room, you know, from one side. And if you shoot an entire reverse angle, you have to put up a fourth wall so that you're not seeing the audience
right.
Behind the actors.
Instead of waves and seagulls.
Right. So, you know, when we do that, we'll do that on a Thursday and cut it together quickly, you know, a rough cut, and in context of the entire story, play it back for the audience on monitors. There's monitors all over the place so that everyone can see. If the cameras are in their way, they can see what's happening on monitors. But we'll play it back, and the warm-up guy will say, "Watch your monitors. The next scene was shot yesterday, and we'll show it to you." And we'll show them a rough cut of the scene, and the mics are hot, and we record their response. And you know, and we absolutely have to try and incorporate their laughter to what they're seeing on the monitors. Because that's the response. It's a real honest response because really now they're not watching live actors. Now they're watching, you know, something that was shot the day before.
Coming up after a short break, more with mega sitcom producer Chuck Lorre about canned laughter, or the lack thereof. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We're talking with Chuck Lorre about the myths and realities of the laugh track. Lorre created the sitcoms Sybil, Dharma and Greg, and Two and a Half Men, currently the number one primetime sitcom in America.
I want to believe in my heart of hearts that I am a rugged individualist who knows what's funny for me. But, for instance, I'm watching this new show on ABC now called Notes from the Underbelly, which is a show about friends and friendship and pregnancy and how it changes all of that. Mm-hmm. And there's no laugh track, sort of no audience. It's clearly shot very cinematically.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I wonder, you know, as this show struggles to find an audience, you know, I want to believe that I know when to laugh. But do I? I mean, like, I guess what I'm doubting.
Sure you do. Why would you doubt your humanity? I mean, it's true. The truth of the matter is that the laugh reflex is a human reflex. Why would it be doubted? I mean,
I don't doubt it, but I wonder if my feelings about the show might be different. And testing sort of, you know, goes to this, that people might feel differently about the experience they just had. You know, if you show one group of one people one thing and they say, hey, I really like that, and you show them the same thing without the laughter and they say, you know, like, can we be led, or you reject that? It seems like you reject that.
The audience rejects it on a regular basis, and shows don't fulfill the promise they make, then the audience doesn't watch them. And they don't survive. I mean, there was a time on television when there was, you know, when there was only three networks, that there was a lot more, you know, perhaps flexibility to what you might call failure. But now it's you know, if you haven't, you know, there's an implicit contract with a half hour show. Laughter, and if that contract isn't fulfilled, people leave. And that's the beauty of the system. It's, you know, it's free to get in and it's free to walk out, you know.
Well, we're going to walk out there. Chuck Lorre is the creator of the most popular show on TV in primetime.
Call it by its name.
Yeah, you're right. Chuck Lorre is the creator of Two and a Half Men, the number one comedy in primetime right now. He's also the creator of shows like Dharma and Greg and Grace Under Fire. Chuck, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks for inviting me again.
Coming up next, when pitchers want a hit.
Laugh, laugh before I die. It seems so funny to me. Laugh, laugh, you met a guy who taught you how it feels to be lonely. Oh, so lonely. Don't think I'm being funny when I say you got just what you deserve. I can't help feeling you found out today. You thought you were too good, you had a lot of love. Won't say I'm sorry for the things I've said. I'm glad he packed it to go. You kept on bragging he was yours instead. Found you don't know everything that is to know.
USC's School of Cinema and Television has an alumni roster that reads like Mr. Chow's lunchtime reservation list. But those graduates who've made it in the business have really had to do it on their own. Because while film school may prepare students technically and creatively for a career in film or television, it doesn't do as well providing that all-important in you need to get an industry career off the ground. So, in the same way that some medical schools have finally started to teach bedside manner to help their students be better doctors in the real world, USC's Film and TV School created First Pitch a few years ago to help their screenwriting graduates actually sell to Hollywood. It's Saturday morning, a time when college students should rightfully be face down on the lawn, or at least asleep in bed. But a group of USC screenwriting students have gathered in one of the school's sound stages to practice the art of the pitch, that is, selling their TV or movie idea. There are 30 pairs of chairs with small writing desks facing each other. On one side is the pitcher, students in their last year of coursework for their Bachelor or Master of Fine Arts degrees. And on the other side are the listeners, alumni, instructors, and other students. Each pitcher will give their spiel for 5 minutes, get feedback, and then move on to the next desk until they've pitched everyone in the room. Think speed dating for writers. But this is only practice.
when we actually do the first pitch event, we'll be pitching to managers, producers, agents.
Tom Beecher is a master's candidate who will be listening during this session and pitching in the second session this afternoon.
You know, he'll be much more nervous at the actual. I don't think you can duplicate the nerves of actually, you know, pitching 25 times to agents and managers, you know, a week before you graduate from film school that you've, you know, poured 2 years of your life into. It's hard to, like, duplicate that kind of tension, I guess.
Alex Logan is a candidate for a bachelor's degree.
It's, you know, it's hard to get across, like, this is something I've poured my heart into for 8 months, and, you know, this is why you should like it. Please, you know, please don't hate me. So it's getting easier each time, but still it's a little disturbing, a little scary, I guess. I mean, this will be the first time I'll ever pitch anything to anyone that, you know, might want to invest in what I have up to offer. So that's exciting.
This is the sixth year of the first pitch event. And if you listen at all, you can see why the students need the practice. It's tough to cram a complicated idea into just a few minutes.
I'm going to pitch my pilot today.
I have a feature comedy for you today.
Okay, this is a story. It's called Black Flag. It's got a lot of action-adventure elements, but it's very much a drama.
So when I was 15 years old, I worked for the mafia. True story.
I'm pitching Sacred Band. It's a one-hour television pilot. It's a drama.
So the name of this script is called The Great Society. It is a comedy.
All right, in the dark screwball comedy feature, Cult TV, a small-town public access producer, Brian Brosh, decides to kickstart his career by creating a cult-based religion for reality TV show.
And that's Evil Girl.
The listeners are not giving feedback on the script or show idea, but on the presentation of the idea, honing the pitch itself.
That's a hell of a pitch.
Heavy on the first act.
Yeah.
Just a couple of sentences about the second act, a couple of sentences about the third act.
Don't tell the story, tell us what it's about.
Stress a little bit more the threat that they're facing.
I kind of, like, disengaged a little bit on the plot.
Were you able to think of anybody you would cast?
I would have to say, though, that you kind of lost me at gang rape.
So, you pitch your script to a manager or an agent. What's the best that could happen? USC MFA candidate Scott Beecher.
The whole goal is to get your work out there and have people read you, and that's, you know, that's a definitely a big opportunity. You won't have another opportunity to pitch to 20 people that are in the business, you know, after that night. So it's pretty, I think it's pretty important. I think it can be if you do well. I think if you don't do well, I don't think it's that big of a deal.
At the end of the day, this event really isn't about selling a project, but the experience of pitching, and perhaps more importantly, the opportunity to get some face time with real decision makers. Of course, Scott Beecher doesn't really need any help, because he's already got an in.
My cousin's husband's father-in-law, his neighbor, I'm thinking that's going to be the big one.
Special thanks to USC film students Aaron Fullerton, Charlie Charbonneau, John A. Marcusano, C.M. Velasquez, Alex Logan, Kate Powers, Michael Colucci, Lisa Detrolia, and Scott Beecher. Good luck to them and all the students pitching in First Pitch this weekend. And by the way, don't even think about taking any of these ideas. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts covering politics, news, music, arts, and culture. For more details, visit kcrw.com.